news, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia in a bunker below ground. Welcome one and all. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad as always to be your humble host as we go careening all through space and time in pursuit of the enigmatic, like we do every week. Listen on demand via podcasting apps all throughout space and time, and of course streaming online via our station affiliates over there at the UNX Radio Network. And lots of news in recent days, of course, about the James Webb Space Telescope, as we were talking about last week. But now, has the world's most expensive and advanced space telescope actually been damaged by a micrometeoroid? Yeah, that's what some are saying. We also, of course, have the strongest magnetic field ever seen in the universe, artificial gravity on the moon, lots of other topics to address, along with some UAP news, because in recent days there has been a lot of buzz about NASA's forthcoming UAP study. I'm interested too. Lots of people weighing in on this, and in fact, we have a surprise guest this week who's going to be joining us. Should I name this individual now? Should I just go ahead and tell you who this is going to be? Because I hadn't actually planned on being joined by one of the most world-renowned experts on the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. I'll go ahead and tell you. Yeah, it's Seth Shostak. I'd reached out to Dr. Shostak in recent days for a quote for a piece I was working on, and instead of the usual email response, he said, look, have you got time just to do a Zoom? Because in my other line of work with thedebrief.org, we communicate pretty frequently, and Seth just said, look, you know, let's just line up a call. Let's talk. And so that's what we're going to do, and all of you will be treated to this conversation that I recently had with Seth Shostak, because we get into some really interesting areas here. Not just SETI, but also, yes, I did ask him about the forthcoming NASA study. We talked about the Galileo project, headed by Avi Loeb, and also the idea that extraterrestrial technologies, when we do eventually find them, might be artificial intelligence, rather than intelligence of the biological kind. So a lot to get into in our assessment of the strange going on in the world around us this week. But first, a quick take on what's happening in the news. As I mentioned, yeah, there's been some talk about some noticeable damage, as some are terming it, to the James Webb Space Telescope. And Elizabeth Howell over there at space.com says that NASA currently is unsure how much of an effect space rocks in the future could have on James Webb's lifespan after the event exceeded pre-launch expectations of damage. That's not good. As they report, a small space rock has proven to have a big effect on NASA's newly operational Deep Space Telescope. As I alluded to already in the intro, this was believed to be a micrometeoroid that struck the James Webb Space Telescope. This occurred sometime between May 22nd and May 24th, and it impacted one of the observatory's 18 hexagonal golden mirrors. According to Space.com, NASA had disclosed the micrometeoroid strike in June and noted that the debris was more sizable than pre-launch modeling had accounted for. Now scientists on the mission have shared an image that drives home the severity of the blow in a report released on July 12th, describing what scientists on the mission learned about using the observatory during its first 6 months in space. Now the good news is that the overall impact, no pun intended, on the James Webb Space Telescope was pretty minimal. But if we do have a reasonable expectation that future similar events could compromise this telescope, we should be asking, what does this actually mean for the lifespan of the James Webb Space Telescope? You know, right now I think the thing has enough fuel in its reserves that it could potentially last for up to 20 years. I think that that's about double the amount of time that they had hoped that Webb might be able to operate. But then again, at Lagrange Point 2, this gravitationally stable area out there in space where we park it in orbit, it's able to operate pretty efficiently. And it's also able to keep cool enough, at least a portion of the craft, because there's one side that's going to be facing the sun and collecting a lot more heat. And so you got to protect those scientific instruments on board the craft that require cooler temperatures in order to operate. But yeah, it seems that the James Webb Space Telescope is going to be able to stay out there for much longer than expected with the fuel stores that it currently possesses. All of that, maybe, so long as it isn't smashed to bits by micrometeorites or perhaps also larger space objects that could potentially collide with it. So there's a question, you know, if, let's say, there are numerous instances in the years ahead where objects that are, let's say, on known trajectories. They are large enough to be predictable, and Webb can be moved out of the way, right? It can be steered away from those objects. Well, hypothetically, if that's able to be done, it's going to take up some fuel, right? So even successfully avoiding known space objects might diminish the amount of time that Webb can remain in operation. That's just the reality of the situation, I suppose, but yes, indeed, the damage that the spacecraft incurred in recent days is far worse than those pre-launch estimates. Let's hope for the best, because we're seeing some really great stuff coming from Webb already at this early stage in its operations. As far as other things that are going on a little further out there, you know, we had Universe Today recently reporting on a team of astronomers who've used the new Chinese InSight HXMT observatory to study a distant ultra-luminous pulsar, which they have called JO243.6+6124. These names, I always have to comment on them. The most memorable names that we give to space objects, but again, there is a naming convention. I get it. They do the same thing with archaeological sites. This particular pulsar, though, according to Universe Today, has an orbiting companion, they say, that appears to have wandered a little too close. And that pulsar's extreme gravity, they say, is currently in the process of tearing apart that companion, forcing its material into a thin accretion disk around the pulsar. They also note, here in the brief article, that occasionally the gas in the accretion disk flares, producing a flash of incredibly bright X-rays. In the spectrum of these X-rays, the astronomers say that they found an absorption line caused by electrons actually knocking away X-rays as they escape. Those electrons can only get that kind of energy, they say, if they're powered by, guess what? A magnetic field. And so, through that observation, across this incredible distance, astronomers were able to directly measure the magnetic field strengths being produced by this pulsar as it's essentially consuming its companion. I guess we could call this cannibalism of the celestial variety. But this also interests me because it's really similar to a story that I reported on recently over there at thedebrief.org that involves a process that's really interesting to me. I didn't even know that this term was in the lexicon of modern physics until I started looking into this, and it's called spaghettification. You ever heard of that? And what it involves essentially is, in the case that I reported on, a star was recently observed being shredded and swallowed by a supermassive black hole that it strayed too close to in the cosmic sense of things. What ends up happening is that as the star is dragged into the black hole, it actually is drawn out into a thin, tapering, super dense, well, really a string of star stuff, to borrow the words of the late Carl Sagan. And what you end up seeing is what they call the spaghettification of a star. But what was also really interesting to me was the fact that as this star is being consumed, there's this stellar debris that forms a cloud around the black hole, and any X-rays escaping from the black hole were completely obstructed by this star stuff forming this cloud. And scientists had long wondered exactly why it was that the expected amounts of X-ray radiation escaping from a black hole wasn't always easily measured. It turns out that indeed, these clouds that form around a black hole like this in such a circumstance can effectively shield those X-rays from escaping and block them from view. And it's always so fascinating to me that even over these incredible distances, astronomers are able to discern so much of what's happening out there in the distant universe. It's just incredible. Now, here's an idea. You may have seen science fiction films over the years where there is a lunar base, but instead of bouncing along like astronauts, as you have probably seen in the Apollo-era footage of men on the moon, no, in science fiction films, people walk around as though it's, well, Earth. And there's a simple reason why, because these movies are all made on Earth. But this brings to mind a really interesting question. Is it possible to replicate Earth-style gravity on the moon? Well, according to the latest studies, maybe so. And according to Matt Williams, writing for Universe Today, by way of Phys.org, who among the problems that humans face in terms of space travel, right, exposure to radiation, things like this, there is also the issue of low gravity, which he says is especially pressing for long-term missions and habitats beyond Earth. Now think about this for a moment. You may think to yourself, what about having Earth-style gravity is so important? But studies in recent years with astronauts who have gone into space and spent time there for significant periods actually show that muscular atrophy occurs. People seem to age differently and usually not for the better. Yeah, we as humans have evolved to exist comfortably in the little homeostatic zone that we occupy down on the surface of Earth. And so when humans spend a lot of time in space far enough away from the gravity zone down on ground level that we are used to, keeping in mind, of course, that that gravitational influence that is exerted by the Earth diminishes a little bit the further that we get away from it, and eventually weightlessness ensues once we get far enough away. But yes, if you are unencumbered by gravity, it's actually not good for human health. And so we're trying to figure out how in the future, when we have long-term space missions, we can overcome problems like this. Well, according to a new study carried out by a team of Japanese researchers, they're saying that if we want to be able to do this on the moon, simulate gravity, and thereby help to ensure a safe and productive environment for humans, we may need to build a rotating habitat. And as the PhysOrg article here notes, on July 5th, representatives from Kyoto University and the Kajima Corporation, one of the oldest and largest construction companies in Japan, have announced that they will be partnering to conduct a study on the concept of a rotating space station and how it could make humanity's plans for living on the moon and even Mars a reality. To my earlier point about the long-term effects of space travel on humans, they note here the effect of microgravity on human physiology is well documented, thanks to many experiments involving long-term stays on the ISS, which includes NASA's famous twin study. It is established that astronauts will experience a loss in muscle mass and bone density. Recent research has also shown that the loss of bone strength is something astronauts never fully recover from. Well, that's not really good, is it? Other noted effects, they say, include changes in cardiovascular health, organ function, eyesight, and of course, there are also psychological effects, even gene expression. But long story short, if we want to be able to overcome these things, presumably, in the future, it's going to require simulating gravity. Not unlike, perhaps, what you've seen in some sci-fi films, but now that science fiction concept is becoming a reality, and perhaps a rotating lunar base, according to this team of Japanese researchers, would be our ticket to increasing the long-term capabilities of our future space missions. But getting away from some space news here for just a minute, you know, I am so fascinated with plants. And my first book, Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule, dealt in part with entheogenic substances, plants that release unique chemicals that cause mind-altering experiences, psychedelic hallucinogens like DMT found in a variety of different plants, and things like this. But something else that's rather interesting that it's been observed now that plants will produce is their own aspirin when they get stressed out. That's right, Science Alert reporting here, and this is just incredible to me. A new study takes a closer look at this particular self-defense mechanism, they say, and how apparently the production of the active metabolite found in aspirin, this is salicylic acid, is regulated by these plants. As the article here notes, salicylic acid has been used by humans for centuries as a treatment for pain and inflammation, but in plants it plays a fundamental role in signaling, regulation, and pathogen defense. Produced in chloroplasts, those little green organelles where the process of photosynthesis is carried out, it's typically generated in response to stress. And that, according to Wilhelmina van den Ven from University of California, Riverside, says, it's like these plants use a painkiller for aches and pains just like we do. Now, we often think of ourselves as being so different from plants, right? And other animals, for that matter. But, of course, add to this the other dimension here where animals often seem to intuitively know which plants produce these kinds of substances, and they will chew on them when they have a headache, or if they have a toothache, or an injury, they'll rub these kinds of things on them. It's fascinating to me in the natural world how we kind of stumble onto these incredible capabilities. And in the case of plants, they actually produce these things, which have these effects on other organisms, namely humans. I've featured an audio soundbite in the past, featuring Dr. Brett Weinstein, the evolutionary biologist and also brother to Eric Weinstein, who's recently kind of begun to weigh in on the UFO debate. I'd love to talk to both those guys at some point. But Brett Weinstein, being an evolutionary biologist, says, you know, plants are incredible because although it's a very slow build over time, the way that they have evolved to reward other organisms that they interact with, I mean, it gets downright spooky sometimes. If you think about, for instance, spicy vegetables, right? Peppers. Plants produce these with the expectation that certain mammals are not going to eat those fruits, but that spiciness isn't going to affect a bird, for instance, and thereby, what's the plant doing? Well, it's providing a free lunch that's laden with seeds to exactly the kind of organism that it knows is going to take that food, carry it a long distance, and when that bird drops the remnants of that lunch, the seeds it consumed when eating, for instance, a pepper, along with a little microdose of fertilizer, courtesy of Mr. Bird, and it's going to be deposited somewhere far off, ready-made, and all set for seed germination on the ground elsewhere. Which, again, is really fascinating if you think about it. How does a plant know to encourage a bird to eat its fruit, seemingly with, and again, I hesitate to use this kind of expression, but seemingly with an awareness that the bird is going to be the most effective organism in terms of helping that plant spread its seed in the most literal sense. Same kind of thing applies to pollinators, right? When we've got bees and other insects that use pollen for food, and they are helping plants reproduce, again, plants are really capable of spreading themselves around without having to actually move themselves. If anything, they put other organisms to work for them doing that. And that to me is absolutely incredible. The many mysteries of nature, ladies and gents, and let me tell you, there are plenty of them out there. But of course, later this year, NASA is going to be digging into one of those great mysteries, and that involves unidentified aerial phenomena. In recent days, there's been a lot of buzz about this NASA study. And I want to talk about this a bit and also get a few of those views that have been in the news cycle in recent days when we return right here on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks program, always with an eye on the skies and looking to space and beyond. You know, one thing that is currently uniting a lot of people, especially Americans, actually is space. And according to a recent piece over there at 538.com, this was retweeted, by the way, by my buddy Alejandro Rojas, always appreciative of Alejandro and his work. But this piece over at 538.com has to do with a poll that, not unbelievably, in fact, perhaps predictably, showed how much Americans seem to agree on space. That's right. As the authors note here, it turns out this is one of the few areas where Americans largely agree. In a July 2021 poll from YouGov and The Economist, a majority of Americans said the U.S. should send astronauts to the moon and Mars. This was true across political parties, with slim majorities for Democrats, Republicans, and Independents. Most Americans, they say, are on the same page about funding space exploration, too. Listen to this. About a third of Democrats, Republicans, and Independents said that government funding of space exploration should be kept the same, and about 40% of each group said that funding should be increased. And of the authors of this post over there at 538, note, they say, find me another issue where roughly the same share of Republicans and Democrats agree that the government is not spending enough money. But wait, because there is more later in the article. The authors also note that we all know water is a key ingredient of life. So wherever we detect it on another planet, it tends to conjure up mental images of extraterrestrial life. And of course, this all with a nod to the recent images collected by the Webb Space Telescope, which showed very clearly that there's a lot of hydrogen and oxygen out there in the atmospheres of distant exoplanets. But on the subject of ET, in this article, they say on the question of alien life forms, Democrats and Republicans are also aligned. In a Morning Consult Politico poll from back in May, registered voters were asked whether they believed life existed outside of Earth. Roughly the same share of Democrats, Independents, and Republicans, 28%, 25%, and 23% respectively, said yes, definitely. Another 40% of Democrats, 37% of Independents, and 32% of Republicans said yes, probably. Now you can probably sense where this is going. As the authors state here, Americans are also equally conspiratorial on this front when it comes to the search for alien life. 79% of Democrats, 73% of Independents, and 84% of Republicans said that the government has definitely or probably hidden evidence of UFOs from the public. Wow. I guess finding consensus among American voters isn't hard. You just have to look a little further. Yeah, further out, like outer space in this case. But, you know, on that final point right there, when they talk about the notion that the United States government has not been forthcoming with information it has collected with UFOs. What an idea, right? What a concept. What? What do you mean you haven't been telling us everything that you guys know, right? Big surprise. But it is interesting to me that we see so much bipartisan support for those ideas. Again, the figures that they give here. 79% of Democrats, 73% of Independents, and 84% of Republicans responding that they think the government either has definitely or probably hidden evidence of UFOs from the public. Now, of course, there are always going to be people who try to politicize issues like this. But if anything, the big takeaway seems to be that there is, across the board, a whole lot of consensus in terms of people's attitudes about the UFO topic. Now, staying with that for a moment, jumping now over to Newsweek, Ed Brown, reporting on this in advance of this big NASA study, writes that Daniel Evans, Assistant Deputy Director Administrator for Research at NASA's Science Mission Directorate, who is responsible for orchestrating this forthcoming study, has told Newsweek that the report is expected to reach completion in the spring of 2023. They say that same month, Dmitry Rogozin, head of Russia's space agency Roscosmos, suggested that Russia is also giving some consideration and recognition to the UAP reports that it collects, presumably, although I'll also point out this is a pretty common occurrence. If the U.S. comes out and says anything, as far as, well, we're collecting data about this phenomena, China comes out and says, yeah, and we're going to use AI and do it better than you guys. Roscosmos may be doing the same, probably, I'll point out, because when it's announced that NASA's going to do a UAP study, the press in Russia starts asking Rogozin the same, and he says, well, yeah, I'm sure we look at these things, but there doesn't appear to be an official study going on in Russia right now. That's the distinction, I think. But coming back to Ed Brown's article here, he says the claim might be taken with a pinch of salt since Rogozin is a controversial figure known for making sensational statements. But, he notes, it does suggest that official recognition of the UFO phenomenon, or UAP as they call it now, has not been limited to the United States. Now, although I have plenty of problems with Ed's reporting here, bear with me for a moment, because this does involve Seth Shostak, who will be joining us here shortly. Ed writes that away from the murky world of UFOs and back into hard science, researchers around the world are scanning the skies for signs of life, a radio signal that carries the telltale characteristics of having been artificially designed. In this regard, China could be a world leader with its colossal 500-meter aperture spherical telescope, or FAST radio observatory, the biggest of its kind in the world. They say, indeed, researchers at the Chinese Academy of Sciences and the University of California, Berkeley have teamed up to use that telescope specifically for extraterrestrial signal searches, producing a report earlier this year, but until recently that hadn't been the case. Here they quote Seth Shostak, who notes of China's recent ET ambitions that the Chinese are getting involved, and other countries in Europe finally are also getting involved, noting that the area of study has typically been essentially restricted to the United States. They're talking about SETI here. Shostak also notes the British haven't done it. I lived in Holland for a long time. The only time we ever did any SETI experiment was when I was there, pushing them a little bit. Germans haven't done anything. The French really haven't done it. Only the Italians in Europe have made some significant effort to do SETI experiments. Now, what kind of interests me here, and we're going to come back around to the NASA UAP study that's going to take place later this year here in a moment, but what interests me is that Ed Brown, although his reporting takes a slightly dismissive tone toward UAP despite the fact that NASA's getting into the game, right, and planning to conduct their own scientific study, that should be significant, right? Well, back to the hard science world of SETI, he says. Ladies and gents, and Mr. Ed Brown in particular, let me point out, NASA is going to be conducting a serious scientific review of UAP data. That is also hard science. Newsflash, Newsweek. But indeed, as we are comparing traditional SETI and now the burgeoning interest in UAP, there are some really interesting analyses that we could do here, because many would say that SETI was once fringe and now it's considered the respectable way to search for extraterrestrial life. Now, we don't know if that's what UAP represent, but we do have to recognize that it is something that UAP could represent. We don't know yet. What if, in all our searching for extraterrestrial life, we spent so much time looking out there, whereas in fact they, or perhaps their technology, maybe their AI, for all we know, was hidden right under our nose? One more reason it's going to be really interesting to get Seth Shostak's perspectives on all this, because in the past he's been pretty dismissive of UFO research in general, but I think he also provides a very necessary counterbalance to that debate, and we'll get more of his perspectives on all that here shortly. But indeed, if SETI was once somewhat fringe, now it's respectable. Are we seeing UAP research go in a similar direction? Will we one day have another mode of investigation of the possibility that there is intelligent life out there? And we will once say, you know, UAP was once a long maligned subject. Nobody took it seriously. And then in 2017, you know, things begin to change. We have all these developments begin to occur. Scott Bray and guys like that are briefing Congress about information that's been collected by the Navy and others. All of a sudden it began to change and UAP became respectable. Remember back when it wasn't? Well, people are saying that right now about SETI. Yes, SETI used to be fringe. And in fact, we're now seeing guys like Seth Shostak who have been traditionally more dismissive of UFO reports and investigations. We're now coming out in defense of guys like Avi Loeb and their insistence that we as scientists must look at UAP. It is incumbent upon us to take this seriously. But now Leonard David, who's a longtime contributor to space.com, where, by the way, as I've mentioned previously, my good buddy Brett Tingley is now an editor. And so Brett, of course, knowing I would find this interesting, sent this one along in my direction here. But Leonard David asked for space.com recently, how big a deal is NASA's new UFO study? As David notes, the intent is to move the scientific understanding of UAP forward, that according to Thomas Zurbuchen, who said so during a press call that in fact I was actually one of the members of the media in attendance for. In a statement released shortly thereafter, and I'll quote, Zurbuchen said, NASA believes that the tools of scientific discovery are powerful and apply here also. We have access to a broad range of observations of Earth from space, and that is the lifeblood of scientific inquiry. We have the tools and team who can help us improve our understanding of the unknown. That's the very definition of what science is. That's what we do. That quote actually harvested from that conversation with the press that day on that phone line, where the audio was so terrible we couldn't even hear what some of the participants were trying to say. Seriously, guys, just do a Zoom next time. But as Leonard David tends to do, he goes down the list and asks a number of UFO experts what they think about this. My good pal Robert Powell, executive board member of the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies, was one of those. And this is what Robert had to say about the forthcoming NASA study. He said, during their press conference, it was clear that they would provide an exemplary approach to the subject by combining scientific rigor, transparency, and fundamental curiosity about this long-standing mystery. All scientists interested in the study of these phenomena should welcome NASA's entry into the arena as an indication that the time has come for the scientific community to openly examine this subject, and it is hoped that Congress will appropriate funding to open the study of this enigma to all of academia. David also gets quotes from Avi Loeb, Leslie Kane, and a number of others in this article. But maybe my favorite quote from the article actually comes from our friend Mark Rodiger, who currently is and has long been the scientific director for the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies in Chicago. Rodiger said that NASA's new UAP initiative is very encouraging, perhaps even more so than the formation of the Airborne Object Identification and Management Synchronization Group in the Pentagon. UAP, he said, are best investigated openly, because both this will allow a range of qualified researchers to be involved, but also because this will permit the results of the investigation to be shared with the public. Now, go back to that 538 poll from earlier. Note the amount of bipartisan support for the idea that the government has not been forthcoming with UAP data. And in light of that, what Dr. Rodiger is saying right here is of fundamental importance. He goes on to say, telling David, I have concern that findings will, as a matter of course, not be shared with the public. Now, mind you, he's not talking about the NASA study right there. No, he's talking about the military's collection with its advanced sensor capabilities of UAP data, about which it tells us extremely little. He goes on to say, those of us who have been advocating for years that more resources be devoted to studying UAP have always recommended this be done openly and transparently. So really, in truth, who better to do it than NASA? Of course, as is always the case, I'll have Leonard David's entire space.com article linked in the show notes, along with other UAP news and other news stories we cover on the podcast. But I want to share one final quote from his article here from Mark Rodiger, where Rodiger points out something that he actually told me, but in a different context, back last winter. At that time, it was unclear whether we would have the AOI-MSG and this ASTRO or ASRO organization, variously given different names at times, under the Gillibrand Amendment, within the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2022. Now, it was subsequently confirmed to me by Susan Goff at the Pentagon that, well, the AOI-MSG is the sole investigative branch. That's why it's not named in the version of the NDAA amendment that went to law, right? They just talk about the office. So they have essentially said, we established the AOI MSG, but it's going to do what Congress directs it to do. Nonetheless, at that time, while there was still some confusion about this, Mark Roediger said, you know, are we going to have two different investigative groups? There's a potential for some overlap, but also maybe that good old left hand isn't seeing what the right hand does, right? Well, here we are again now with two separate government studies. At first, there was confusion on that point. Now, it's confirmed. You've got your AIMSOG over there at the DOD. Not a whole lot of information likely to be shared with the public from that effort. At least not now, maybe never. And then you've got NASA. How much access to information from the military will they have? But here's what Roediger had to say about all this. He says, down the road, there could be potential for overlap and redundancy in the two efforts. But science is normally best done with multiple research groups working on the same problem, and UAPs are no different. He also says, I do hope that NASA reaches out to the serious UFO community because we can advise them on data and data quality issues that we understand from long experience. Our involvement will make their study more robust and comprehensive. Now, the question, of course, is how likely is it that civilian data collected by civilian UFO groups will be included in NASA's study? I don't get my hopes up, but I do hope, nonetheless, that it's something they consider. Hey, let's get Seth Shostak's considerations about NASA's study and much more when we come back here in a moment on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad as always to have you guys along for the ride as we continue our examination of the anomalous every week. And of course, don't forget, if you aren't already an X subscriber, you're only getting half of the story. That's right. Every week we continue our dialogue for X subscribers, and that's just $7 a month or $77 a year to get you full access to your own unique RSS feed where you get this show, the weekly additional edition, the X podcast, and also the monthly Enigmas special. And of course, that entire back catalog available there too, so definitely check that out. We have the link to where you can sign up right there in the show notes. It's easy, it's fun, and I'll remind you guys, it's the best way to support the efforts of your friendly neighborhood podcaster. So with that out of the way, let's get right back into the thick of things, because in recent days, I was interested in reaching out to a few open-minded astronomers, not ufologists per se, but trying to get their perspectives about the likelihood that eventually, when we discover evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence, it may not be those ETs. In fact, it may be their technology, maybe even artificially intelligent technology that we discover. And this, to me, not only raises a number of interesting questions with regard to the UAP debate, but also really how we proceed if this were the case with SETI and other searches for alien intelligence. So one of the people I reached out to was Seth Shostak, who is the senior astronomer there at the SETI Institute, and he hit me back up. He said he was in Germany in recent days. His travel was delayed. He got back to the United States much later than expected. Hey, it's going to be easier if we just chat. And of course, I have no qualms whatsoever with that, and so I am very happy to welcome to the program lead astronomer with the SETI Institute, Seth Shostak. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, Micah. A little bit jet lagged. See, I'm jet lagged.
Yes, I understand.
I was on travel last week.
I understand you had quite an adventure in recent days. You know, of course, for folks at home, this is the host of the SETI Institute weekly science radio show, Big Picture Science, author of 3 trade books on SETI and more than 600 popular articles on science, many of which I have read. And so you've really been an innovator in that field, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Well, it's kind of you to say that. It's also kind of you to have read all that.
I'm an avid reader indeed. What I wanted to talk with you about today has to do actually with, in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, One of the less often discussed aspects, a sort of tangent topic to that, but one really that makes a lot of logical sense. Here on Earth, with the advent of machine learning and deep learning, artificial intelligence, some would say, is right around the corner. And it seems very plausible that an intelligent civilization, maybe beyond us in their advancement, maybe hundreds, if not thousands of years, that they also would be developing artificial intelligence, which raises the novel question, what if the ET intelligence that we find were artificial? And I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, I happen to agree with the premise. I mean, when we think of what aliens might be like, most people, I think, are tempted by what they see in the movies or on television, you know, little gray guys with not much body hair, not much in the way of clothing, for that matter, you know, big dark eyes, that kind of thing. And that's become a sort of a iconic view of what the aliens may look like. But it assumes that the aliens are even biological. And we're keen on biology. All the intelligence that we know about here on Earth is biological. But as you know, we're developing artificial intelligence, not just to play chess or Go or poker or anything like that, but to be able to, you know, write music, write novels, frankly, to do anything a human can do with their brain.
Absolutely. Organic intelligence, in fact, some would say, may just be kind of an interlude, to put it poetically, in the history of a civilization before machine intelligence actually rises to prominence. Now, I've read, of course, the work of Nick Bostrom and others who have looked at this from a philosophical perspective. I do want to ask you also, do you think it's even likely that an AI superintelligence could be a danger to humans here on Earth? And if that prospect is a possibility, what about a machine intelligence from elsewhere?
Yeah, well, it's a little hard to say whether it's likely that there would be malevolence from a machine intelligence, because after all, we haven't met any, and we have no idea what what their needs and wants and desires might be, even assuming that those words are all applicable. All you can say is that in a society that's governed by Darwinian evolution, right, as ours is, then there's always room for a small number of bad behavior people, if you will, guys. You know, bad behavior can be rewarded as long as it doesn't get out of control. If the whole society is, you know, dishonest or murderous or something like that, it collapses. But if you have, 1% of the population that's stealing from people or whatever, they might get away with it. So there's always some survival benefit in a Darwinian system for a little bit of bad behavior around the edges. Now, whether that would be true for machine intelligence, a little hard to say. It depends on whether the machines are competitive with one another. And it's not clear to me that they would be. Maybe you just have one giant machine, in which case there are no enemies, there are no other machines.
Yeah, it's obviously virgin territory, and there's a whole lot more speculation on account of, as you mentioned, the fact that we have not met artificial intelligence, truly sentient, autonomous, thinking machines like we see in science fiction. Some would contend maybe we will never see that. But if that is indeed a likelihood at all, we have to also face the possibility that other intelligences may actually produce it as well, and that we may meet that. Now, from a SETI perspective, again, you know, truly being a pioneer in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, that being the operative word, I wonder how the prospect of artificial intelligence changes the work of SETI, either in terms of the search for prospective intelligences, or how maybe artificial intelligence could be useful in that search from here on Earth. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, certainly the latter, Mike. But we can use these machines, these AI machines, and, you know, some experiments are starting to do that, to recognize whether we've picked up a signal or not. Anybody who's actually sat in at a radio telescope where a SETI experiment is going on know that you pick up signals all the time. It just signals left and right. And some of them look very, very strange on the display screens that are arrayed in front of the scientists. And the scientists have to decide, well, does that look like something that I ought to spend time following up? Or is that a well-known source of interference? Or is it something else? And AI can help here, because what you can do is just feed the AI machine. You just feed it, you know, tens of thousands of examples of interference signals that, you know, are not real. And so it can recognize them the next time, and you can continue, you know, eating your ham sandwich while the instrument continues to look for ET.
I like the way that you word that. You know, I've seen the idea put forward also, Seth, that if indeed we had autonomous intelligence that was perhaps, you know, capable of going off planet in a distant star system, and maybe also capable of powering itself, you know, from the energy it receives from suns as it moves through distant galaxies, maybe beyond those galaxies and travels through space. In that kind of a situation, some have put forward the idea that an artificial form of extraterrestrial intelligence might not even reside on planets as what we know and what generally with SETI we are looking for. So here again, the question I would ask of you is, if we're looking for something that is mobile in that sense, how does that change the approaches and strategies for SETI researchers like yourself?
Yeah, well, it introduces a really big problem because, as you just note, a machine doesn't need to reside on a planet, right? You know, we like a planet that has an atmosphere and rain and stuff like that, but we don't rust. And maybe, you know, these machines might rust. In any case, they don't need all the harsh conditions here. All they need is a little bit of energy, maybe a lot of energy, and some material that they can use to fashion replacement parts if that becomes an issue. So, you know, they could just hang out between the stars. They don't have to be on a planet at all. If they're hanging out between the stars, they can use all sorts of ways to generate energy for themselves. And as far as, you know, spare parts, they're just going to have to make them themselves. They can't order them on Amazon. So, yeah, they're not tied to planets. And that makes SETI a little more difficult because you no longer know where to look for what you're looking for.
Indeed. You know, there are so many dynamics in all of this right now. And that leads to another tangent to this discussion. There are big distinctions between the SETI programs and the way that this goes about, you know, traditional SETI, looking for evidence of extraterrestrial life, and a new topic that many are kind of coming to this realization that we should probably put scientific attention toward as well, which is UAP, Unidentified Aerial Phenomena. Now, you're an advisory board, I believe, on Dr. Avi Loeb's Galileo project, which also hopes to try and collect scientific data about this. As of last July, there was a great piece that you did in Scientific American, where you wrote of that endeavor that, as a SETI scientist, I'm grateful that he, Avi, has the freedom and the guts to go where few would dare go. Could you expand on that a little and your feelings about what Galileo Project is doing and also the general scientific search for what are now called UAP?
Yeah. Well, the idea that we might be being visited is hardly a radical idea anymore. Something like 1 out of 3 Americans believe it's true that the aliens are here. And all we have to do is, you know, put out the welcome mat and maybe they'll come in and, you know, maybe they'll just haul us out of our bedrooms. They always seem to do that. But it is a serious topic. In a sense, it's always been a serious topic. It's just that there hasn't been much there. In the early 1950s, there was a lot of follow-up of what were then called UFO sightings by the military, the Air Force in particular, because, you know, it needed to know what was up there in our airspace, obviously. And that's still the case. This time, it seems to be the Navy that's been visited by the aliens. But personally, I don't think that we're being visited at all. I don't think any of this evidence points to visitation. I think it points to various phenomena intrinsic to the kind of cameras that were used to make the footage that everybody's seen, the 3 videos and so forth. But on the other hand, once again, you know, if you're the U.S. military, you want to know, look, maybe it's not aliens. Maybe it's just Chinese drones. Maybe it's, you know, something funky about our equipment. Whatever it is, they want to know what it is. So they're going to study it. And I think that's a good deal. And as far as Avi Loeb, here's a credentialed, very sophisticated academic. I mean, he was head of the Harvard Astronomy Department for years, actually. And he's, you know, putting effort into trying to get high resolution photos of UAPs, which would be good proof that there's something there.
Indeed, if he's able to get those images, I mean, that would really be a game changer. You know, coming back around to what you said about the Navy, and I've, of course, heard in many interviews that you've done over the years, and actually I've always wanted to ask you about this, so I'm glad you mentioned that. If indeed the Navy is leading that effort and it's their cameras that are filming these, am I correct in my understanding that your general idea has been we should look at how those Navy systems work, you know, how the targeting pod, the AT-FLIR, which is actually the camera system that has filmed these objects or purported objects, your contention would be that we should start there and then maybe work our way up in terms of trying to resolve what these may be?
Yeah, I think so. Look, a lot of people will say, man, look at that thing moving across the screen. That's, you know, moving at speeds that none of our aircraft could manage. Clearly, this is something beyond the technical capabilities of Homo sapiens. But, you know, statements like that don't really mean too much because how fast it's moving depends on knowing how far away it is, right? I mean, if a fly zips by in the front of my face, you know, I might think, my God, that fly is doing Mach 10 or something. But it's so close that it's actually not. We don't know the distance of any of these things. Maybe we do. I mean, maybe that wasn't in the public report. But still, there were radars that were following at least some of these things. And, you know, that would give you a distance. But the trouble is that the radars, the one on the planes, don't look that very that far in front of the plane. They're designed to find targets, namely other airplanes that you want to shoot down. They're not particularly good at finding something that might be 50 miles in front of you. So that information, I think, if you don't have that, then it doesn't make any sense to talk about things like speeds and accelerations and all that stuff.
Or maybe star stuff, as Carl Sagan would have said. I'm sure we have a Sagan fan here in Seth Shostak, who was kind enough to sit down with us this week and discuss artificial intelligence and what role that might play in the search for extraterrestrial life. A lot more to discuss with him, as well as, of course, some of this NASA research into UAPs that's going to be happening soon. Seth Shostak and I will be back right here in a moment on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad to be your host. Glad to have joining me for the conversation this week, Seth Shostak. You know, Seth has always raised what I think are very valuable perspectives on the UAP discussion. Now, I don't always agree 100%, but that's all right. You know, you don't have to agree all the time with everybody. But I want to remind you, of course, head on over to SETI.org. That's SETI.org to see all about the SETI Institute and follow Seth's work there at the website. But picking up where we left off, you know, Seth, we'd talked a bit about the collection of data by the military about UAP. And although that's good, that's hopeful, there's also the problem that we may not get access to all that information. This is why Avi Loeb and others have said it's incumbent upon scientists to collect information ourselves so that we can get around the hurdles presented by the government having to protect the ways that it collects information. Do you think it's indeed incumbent upon us as scientists to look for our own data and to rely on that more than whatever the government may be collecting about UAP? Your thoughts?
No, absolutely. And Avi Loeb has made that point explicitly in some of the meetings of his Galileo project that, you know, he doesn't want to deal with the military because the military will be secretive. It's not necessarily malevolence. It's just what you say. There's some things you just don't want to make general knowledge because they're of use to potential enemies. I mean, that's their job, to protect the place, to protect the government and the population of the United States. So, you know, they may not tell you everything. But of course, that sets things up for a very interesting discussion by people who say, well, look, you claim that these are not good enough videos to say anything about aliens. And I say to you that they would be, except that the government is covering up information we would need to understand what's going on here, like radar distances and so forth and so on. So it's perfectly set up for more conspiratorial thinking. Right. And that's the beauty of the whole thing. You can always say at the end of the road or the end of the day, anyhow, you can always say something like, well, they're keeping something from us. And when you're talking about the military does keep stuff from you. So, you know, that could go on forever.
Indeed. Yeah, it's not illogical to be concerned about whether the full spectrum of data that we may be collecting is available to the public. But that's one reason, Seth, that I'm so excited about what NASA has recently announced. And of course, in recent days, we've seen some of the clearest, most high definition images of the cosmos, courtesy of the James Webb Space Telescope. I mean, talk about an exciting time for astronomy. But they've also announced that later this year, NASA will be undertaking its own study of UAP. And with their history of transparency, and in fact, their commitments to transparency on this issue, releasing the full report to the public, to me, this could be one of the most promising scientific developments in relation to that subject that we've seen in decades. How do you feel about the NASA study involving UAP and where this could go, and what advice would you give them in their search?
Yeah, well, the big advantage of having NASA look at this is the fact that NASA is indeed funded with your tax dollars. They are obliged to be open with what they find. I mean, if you want to use some Hubble telescope data or James Webb telescope data, right? All right. In the beginning, scientists might get priority so they can publish whatever interesting things they've discovered. But after a certain period of time, I don't know whether it's 6 months or a year or something, it all becomes public knowledge. It's out in the public domain. There are people who think that NASA is conspiratorial in the sense that they're hiding stuff from us. I've worked for NASA. There are a lot of NASA employees just about, 2 miles from where I'm sitting. And I don't think that's a good characterization of them. They are civil servants. They are employees of the government. They're the same people that were sitting next to you in class when you were a kid, right? There's nothing terribly evil about NASA employees. So, yeah, I think that that's the major point here. If NASA does its own investigation, then you'll have a hard time, I think, you would have a hard time saying, well, okay, they say they don't find any evidence of extraterrestrials, but they're covering up. That's the problem. That argument can always be used. But in the case of NASA, it's going to be a lot harder than it would be to say that the Air Force or the Navy is covering up, because they will cover up stuff. NASA doesn't.
Yes, indeed. What science strategies would you envision, Dr. Shostak, in terms of what NASA could be doing and how they may be most efficient in trying to unravel this UAP question? What kind of data would you recommend that they look at?
Well, look, there are 8,000 functioning satellites in orbit around the Earth. Almost all of them are aimed downward, right? They're used for weather reporting, crop management, all sorts of stuff, right? And some of these have pretty high resolution. I mean, if you go on Google Earth, and that's not the highest resolution data by far, but anyhow, even on Google Earth, I have no trouble seeing my car, right, parked in the driveway. And, my car is, 10 feet long or something like that. So any alien saucers or whatever they pilot, that are at least 10 feet in size, they could be easily seen even with that satellite. And consequently, I mean, I think that that's a terrifically good resource. I think that, in fact, if you really want to look for UAPs, it's fine to build your own equipment. But on the other hand, there's this equipment that's already been paid for, costs billions of dollars. It's orbiting the Earth every 90 minutes. Why don't we look at that and just make this a data processing problem instead of a hardware construction problem?
Indeed, yes. As Avi Loeb has said in the past, the skies are not classified. And in fact, actually, civilian agencies with their satellites and their imagery are now even being outsourced by geospatial groups, National Geospatial Intelligence here in the United States, as I understand it, because of the efficacy and the equipment in their satellites and their camera imaging systems. So if we can access that in the public sphere, all the better as well. As we're wrapping up here, and coming back around full circle, I do, of course, want to ask, on that outside chance, I think good skepticism in science is always important. And that's why I think, as a person who's always pushed back a little skeptically on the UFO question, to see you supporting people like Avi and looking seriously at the idea that, hey, we don't know until we look at it. So let's look at UAP. But on that outside chance that we do start getting good high resolution images, let's say that NASA finds something that they can't easily explain in their photographs that they examine or other data that they process. What's that likelihood in your view, if indeed there is some exotic intelligence, that an artificial form of intelligence would come here?
Yeah, well, as I say, I'm skeptical. I don't think any of the data that I've seen, and of course, I get calls from people who've seen things every day, essentially, and they sometimes send videos and photos and so forth. So I've looked at a lot of material. I don't see anything that makes me think, oh my God, we're being visited. Obviously, that would be extraordinarily interesting and important if true, right? There are many things that would be interesting if true. So, that might be the case. But if it is the case, one thing you got to say is that the aliens don't seem to be very interested in doing anything now that they're here, right? What do? I mean, they fly around and tease Navy fighter pilots, apparently. But, they don't get involved in, international conflict or anything like that. They're not helping us find the cure for cancer. They're not even flattening Los Angeles, which seems to be a favorite pastime of aliens, at least in the movies. So, the fact that they're not doing anything makes them, in a way, something you can completely ignore, even if they were for real. because they just don't affect you. They don't do anything.
Yeah, well, in my view, maybe staying as far away from us as they can is a good idea, especially on the heels of this COVID-19 pandemic we've seen. I can't blame them for wanting to stay at arm's distance. Seth, as we wrap up here, final question for you. What is next for the search for extraterrestrial life in the traditional sense of a SETI researcher like yourself?
Well, there are a number of ongoing programs, most conspicuously the Breakthrough Listen program at the University of California at Berkeley. And they will, within a couple of years, have looked at about 1 million star systems, right? That's a big number, 1 million. Up until today, the total number of star systems looked at is under 10,000, right? By all experiments. That's a small number, but 1 million is 100 times more. So I remain optimistic that if you do an experiment that keeps getting better and you do it long enough, and if there's something to your premise that, in this case, you know, there are aliens out there with some technical capabilities. If you believe all that, if you sign on to all that, then you're going to see something happen, in my opinion, the next 10 years.
Wow. And if you're right on that, we've got to buy you a cup of coffee too, right?
Right, exactly.
Exactly. Dr. Seth Shostak, Senior Astronomer with the SETI Institute, it has been a pleasure, and certainly I hope we will speak again in the future.
Great. Lovely to talk with you.
Yes, indeed. And again, thank you to our guest, Seth Shostak, who was kind enough to join us this week on the program. You can find out all about him and the SETI Institute at SETI.org, SETI.org. As for me, of course, X subscribers, you'll be hearing a little bit more later this week. And you can follow my work online, as always, at MicahHanks.com and at TheDebrief.org, where I'm a regular contributor, editor-in-chief. And of course, we also have the fine contributions of Tim McMillan, Chris Plain, Chrissy Newton, and many others. That about wraps it up for this week's edition of the program, guys. Thanks, as always, for being along for the ride. I'm yours truly, Micah Hanks, your humble host, and I'll catch you guys again here next time on the Micah Hanks program. In the meantime, as always, stay strange out there.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.